Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you August 7th, 2005, from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Probably few institutions play such a large role in our media and in our lives as spectator sports, yet spectator sports receive very little attention and analysis, generally dismissed as the toy department. Well, that will end today on Media Matters. Our guest will be Dave Zirin. We'll be talking about sports and activism in society today. So please join us. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Every 8 years, every radio and TV station in the country must apply to the Federal Communications Commission for renewal of its broadcast license. The process provides an opportunity for those concerned about the quality of their local media to talk directly to the FCC about their concerns. Karen Hennane, a lawyer with Georgetown University's Institute for Public Representation, says one of the little-known ways every local broadcast outlet must serve the public interest is by keeping a public file.
You can access the public file during regular business hours without delay. And if they turn you away and say, come back in an hour, they're acting improperly. If they say, come back tomorrow, we just don't have someone to show it to you, they are acting improperly. If they say, you can't Xerox it, they are acting improperly. My one note on the Xeroxing, they can ask you to pay a reasonable fee for getting pieces of the public file Xeroxed, but they cannot tell you no.
By law, a station's public file must contain several types of documents, including the station's actual license and any related correspondence with the FCC, the last 3 years of written public comment received by the station, and a limited amount of financial information. The public file should also include what Hennane calls an issues and programs list, which is supposed to be an inventory of programming that provides significant treatment of community issues.
Often, it'll be a mess. It'll be a bunch of scraps of paper in a lot of different people's offices, but be persistent and try to get it. They also don't have to organize it in any particular form. Some stations that are really organized will have maybe a page for environmental issues, a page for political issues, a page for international or national, but most of them really don't go that far.
An incomplete public file is a major violation of FCC rules, and the agency is much more likely to take any infraction seriously during the station license renewal process. However, public inspections of a station's public file are incredibly rare because the public doesn't know it has the right to hold local stations accountable. One place where media watchdogs do exist is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. There, the Grand Rapids Institute for Information Democracy keeps tabs on local television news coverage, according to grid director Jeff Smith.
We watch 4 hours of local TV news every day. We do all the stations that are broadcast in our area so we can methodically look at how much election coverage, how they're covering the war, how they're covering race, gender, class issues, how they're covering trade policies, what are they doing about crime and the environment, public schools, all those kinds of things.
This media tracking comes in especially handy when local stations apply to renew their FCC licenses. All TV stations in Michigan must renew their licenses this year, and Jeff says their springtime inventory of local news programming does not reflect well on their local stations.
It does not provide any information for people to make decisions. We had 174 municipal school board elections in our market. We only had 4 election stories for the entire market, and they only focused on one of those municipalities. Otherwise, the rest of them, too bad. But we got 84 Michael Jackson trial stories. We got, you know, over 100 Terri Schiavo stories. We got over 100 stories about the Pope on local TV news.
The FCC is not likely to deny a station its license renewal just because of public feedback, but no station owner likes to build up a negative record in their public file or with the FCC. Most TV and radio stations aren't used to having their licenses challenged, and such feedback might pressure stations to pay closer attention to sentiments in the communities they serve. Organizing locally to challenge broadcast license renewals is also an excellent method for raising awareness among the public on media issues.
And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. Researchers at Sonoma State University just finished an analysis of the boards of directors of the 10 largest media companies in America and found that they share a lot in common. A combined 118 people sit on all 10 boards of directors. In fact, 8 of the 10 companies share common board members. These 118 also happen to sit on the boards of nearly 300 other multinational corporations. The analysis suggests that the interlocking nature between the boards of directors at media companies and those at other corporations may explain why news with a corporate-friendly spin is becoming increasingly the norm at major newspapers and radio and TV networks. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you this Sunday, August 7th, 2005, from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we've got a long-awaited show, much anticipated, I might add, too, by a lot of our listeners who have already chimed in with their interest in the topic. We're going to be discussing sports, the role it plays in our society, and certainly it's a central issue in any analysis of the media. And we have with us today on the phone from Washington the author of a brand new book, which already received an exceptional amount of attention, called What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States. The author, Dave Zirin, who's joining us, is the editor of the Prince George's Post, and he writes the weekly column Edge of Sports, which is available online. I see it all over the place. Dave, welcome to Media Matters.
Oh, great to be here, Bob.
And congratulations on the book. I assume this is your first book?
Yes, it is. First book.
All right. Well, you know, we've got a lot to talk about. There's a lot in this book about sports and about society, and let's get right at it. First of all, the preface to the book, or the foreword, is written by the person you describe as your mentor, Dave Megacy.
Yes.
And I'm 52. I was raised in Cleveland, and I'm well aware of Dave Megacy, but I suspect that the vast majority of people listening to this show, or even sports fans under a certain age, would have no idea who Dave Megacy is. Why don't you tell people about him?
Sure, and you could include me in that, too, as far as somebody who, as of a couple of years ago, had never heard of Dave Megacy or didn't know who he is. And I've been sports obsessive for most of my natural life.
How about your unnatural life?
Yeah, the unnatural life, I actually took a break from sports.
Okay,
good. Talk about that later.
Okay.
But the issue with Dave Megacy is that it started my connection with him, and this will I'll explain who he is, and my relationship with him started when Tony Smith, the basketball player, the female captain of the Manhattanville College basketball team, chose to turn her back on the American flag at the start of the war in Iraq. She started doing this early in 2003 to tremendous media attention, scrutiny, criticism. And ESPN had a television show called Between the Lines, where Dave Megacy appeared to speak out in defense of Tony Smith. And I was watching that show, and they billed him as Dave Megacy from Athletes United for Peace. And I'm watching this, and I'm thinking, wow, I've never heard of Dave Megacy. I've never heard of Athletes United for Peace. I'm trying to sort of eke out some ground to write sports writing from a left-wing, progressive perspective. And I was like, I need to find out who this guy is. So what I did is I looked him up on the web and found out that Dave Megacy was a former linebacker for the St. Louis Cardinals. Now they're the Arizona Cardinals in the 1960s. And that he had written a book called Out of Their League, which was somewhat controversial, but I still didn't know the full story. And I also found out that he worked for the NFL Players Association. So I contacted him and asked him if perhaps I could do an interview with him. And to my surprise and glee, he didn't only say, sure, let's do an interview. He invited me to the NFLPA office to talk face-to-face. And in the time of talking to him, I really just got an education about it changed all of my thinking about the NFL, about its relationship to the 1960s, and the fact that there were people like Dave Megacy in the NFL in the 1960s, people who, were really pulled by movements that were going on in the streets. And Megacy just to tell the story, is somebody who quit the NFL in his prime as an act of political protest, because he really did feel that professional football was a symbol, a morality play that backed up the U.S. war in Vietnam and war in general. And so he took this stand and turned away from the NFL in his prime and wrote this book that's actually being republished this fall. And no, I don't get any royalties from it, but I really do believe in the book because I was able to read an out-of-print version called Out of Their League. And people should get it for the cover alone, which is a shot of Dave Magazzi back in the early 70s with long hair and a beard, wearing shoulder pads, looking like Richard Nixon's worst nightmare.
Yeah, I read the book when it first came out. And it, for those interested in sports literature, it's one of the four or five best books ever written by a professional athlete.
In the pantheon.
It's definitely there. You know, Dave, I think the question that people who are interested in sports and who have progressive politics often hear, and I'm going to give it to you because you address it right off at the beginning of your book. You know, in ancient Rome, when it was a republic, prior to the time of Julius Caesar, there were no gladiators, there was no circus. But after it became an empire and the republic was killed, the Colosseum was built, and the entire culture of gladiators and spectacles for the masses came in with the quite explicit effort to sort of dupe the masses and keep them sort of entertained so they wouldn't question the relations of power in society.
Right.
And a lot of people say that applies. You know, that's what's going on today with professional sports. It's basically a lot of, you know, gladiators that are sort of, you know, keeping people mollified and not paying attention to what's actually going on. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, the connection between then and now is a lot more than just Russell Crowe. There is, in fact, I think sports have always been in every society a reflection of that society. And so what I always give as much ground as possible to people who have those criticisms of sports today, because I think they're absolutely valid. I mean, people who say that sports are, you know, orgies of patriotism. You know, you're absolutely right. I was at a Washington Nationals game a couple of weeks ago where they swore in 20 members of the Marines before game time, while George Bush and Condoleezza Rice looked on from the owner's box, not unlike, you know, Caesar and the emperors of old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you couldn't get anything more. I mean, it was almost like a parody, for goodness sakes. I was like, where's John Cleese and, you know, Eric Idle here? This is ridiculous. And, you know, there's the sexism. You know, any critique of sports has to acknowledge that sports are violently sexist. You know, from the uproar after Janet Jackson showed her breast to the Coors Light twins. And, you know, of course, the racism. I mean, I'm from a town with a team called the Redskins, for goodness sakes. And I know you have a big listenership in Illinois and the whole controversy over the Illini.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that later in the show.
Sure, we'll get there. But it's just to say that I definitely give that ground. But my disagreement with some of the critiques of sports is people who say, like, for example, Noam Chomsky says, and I have tremendous respect for Chomsky, but I think he's wrong on this question, that sports are sort of solely this kind of opiate, that they're a way to get people, like Chomsky says, that people like sports are perfect for the people in power because they're absolutely meaningless. Therefore, they're a wonderful thing for working people to devote time and energy to. You see, I don't think sports are absolutely meaningless. I think sports can be incredible mirrors, not just of reaction, but also struggle. And I think that's why, you know, when we think of things like the civil rights movement, we also get images of Jackie Robinson, the Black Power movement, Muhammad Ali, the women's movement, Billie Jean King. And what I try to do with the book is really tease out that sort of dynamic interplay between the movements off the field and then what's happening at the top levels of sport in the United States.
We're talking to Dave Zirin today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We do have a live show today, so please do call in if you have any questions or comments for Dave Zirin. And the book we're talking about is Dave Zirin's brand new book, What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States, just published, just came hot off the press from Haymarket Books. And it's a book that covers, as you'll hear during the show today, a broad range historically through to the present day of issues concerning sports and society, sports and political activism, the political implications of sport. The number here at WILL AM 580, 333-9455, and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Dave, let's go through some of the historical parts of the book first. And the book's roughly half historical and half contemporary.
Right.
You have a long chapter in the beginning for someone who's just now beginning to get some of the attention that is long overdue. a famous sports writer named Lester Rodney, who you had the privilege of interviewing.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk a little bit about Lester Rodney and what his role has been in sports?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Lester Rodney was the sports editor of the Communist Party's Daily Worker from 1936 to 1958. And that's usually the first thing that makes people stop. They say, wait a minute, the Daily Worker had a sports editor? It's like, yes, they did. They had a sports page. And, I mean, it was a sports page like nothing anybody had ever seen. And that's why the first chapter is called It All Starts with Lester Rodney, because looking back over the 20th century, I felt like he was the first person to really see sports, on the left anyway, as not just sort of like this carnival of reaction, but a place where political ideas could be teased out and political challenges could be organized. And the great thing about Lester Rodney is just how organic he was to these ideas. I mean, the Communist Party had a sports page before 1936, but, I mean, when you go back and read the old copies of it, I mean, it's almost shocking, like, the depths of its condescension.
Mm-hmm.
Like, saying things like, for workers who talk about boxing matches, they might as well just be addicted to drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, almost like a very vulgar version of the Chomsky argument we talked about before. And but they actually had a sports page just to tell workers how stupid they were to like sports. I mean, Chomsky doesn't put out a sports column to tell people how stupid they are to like sports. So it's an extreme vulgarization of that perspective. And Lester Rodney, who at the time was he was a student at NYU. His family had been immiserated in the Great Depression. He was working full time, going to school at night. And this is the mid 30s. And like he said to me, he said in the 30s, if you were either a socialist, a capitalist, or people thought you were brain dead. You know, you were either on a side or people thought you were completely comatose, given mm-hmm. everything that was happening in the world.
Sure.
So Lester Rodney, he gets the Daily Worker, and he loves it, but he's, as a guy who, you know, was a big athlete himself in college, or in high school, he was just completely blown away by how disgusting the sports page was. So he wrote a letter into the Daily Worker's office, and he said, you know what, I can do a better job than this. And they actually hired him as sports editor, and he was sports editor for several years before he even became a party member.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and he put together this sports page where he did things like agitate for the integration of Major League Baseball.
And I think that's really, I'm sorry, Dave Zirin, but I mean, that's the point. Let's really tee off there, because that's a large theme in the book. You have a chapter also on that subject and on Jackie Robinson.
Sure.
You know, a lot of our listeners, again, who aren't necessarily sports fans or don't know their history that well, might not understand just the significance of Jackie Robinson and breaking the color barrier in baseball. Maybe you could explain that.
Yeah, absolutely profound. And it was a campaign that Lester Rodney took up 11 years before Jackie Robinson entered the league. And for 11 years, the Daily Worker sports page was a place where that agitation to break the color barrier took place. I mean, when Jackie Robinson entered the big leagues in 1947, I mean, the shockwaves were just incredible. You know, one of the best writers I've ever written who writes about the late 40s, early 50s in terms of black American struggle is an author, Manning Marable, in his
mm-hmm.
book Race, Reform, and Rebellion. And what Marable writes about, like the effect of McCarthyism, was really the reason why you have all these things happen in the mid-late 40s, like the desegregation of the army, like Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier, but then you don't really have the civil rights movement till 1954-55. And the only way you can explain that kind of 8-year gap where the civil rights movement really should have started is because the political legs were cut out from under it by, like, the witch hunts and whatnot. Now, and I raised that just to say, because when Jackie Robinson came out there in 1947, he was really like the guy standing alone. I mean, you know, there's an old joke about Martin Luther King, or not an old joke, but a truism, that if he'd made the speech on the March on Washington in the 30s instead of the early 60s, he would have been lynched because there wouldn't have been 200,000 people there to back him up. You know, just,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that was like Robinson, frankly,
mm-hmm.
like in terms of him being out there on his own. And Martin Luther King once said about Jackie Robinson, he said he was a freedom rider before freedom rides. He was a sit-inner before sit-ins. And it's he walked the lonesome road to freedom back before integration was fashionable. And what Robinson did was, like Roy Campanella, who was Robinson's teammate, who was an African-American catcher, he liked to say, we were Brown versus Board of Ed before Brown versus Board of Ed. Because there they were, barnstorming through the South, And Lester Rodney, who I should have mentioned before is still alive, was telling me these stories. They're barnstorming through the South, an integrated team, the Brooklyn Dodgers were, playing in front of segregated crowds. A lot of times in cities and in places that had never seen a black person and a white person even work cooperatively together before, or stand on the same field together, or slide into a base and take out somebody as they're trying to make a throw. And Robinson is doing all this in the context of getting bullets sent to him with his name stenciled into the bullets, getting, you know, black cats thrown out onto the field, death threats from the Klan. And in doing so, he actually forced his teammates, many of whom, like Pee Wee Reese, for example, he's the most famous example, were whites from the South, from small towns, forced them to really figure out where they stood mm-hmm. on these questions of race and this emergent consciousness about race. And so it's really just an incredible story, an overlooked story, and I'm very happy that recently, as he's finally in his 90s, Lester Rodney is getting some attention for the work he did, and the Robinson story is frankly receiving its full political due.
We're talking to Dave Zirin today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our phone lines are open at 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Dave Zirin is a sports writer and editor based in suburban Washington, D.C., and the author of the brand new book just published by Haymarket Books called What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States. And that title comes from the figure that graces the cover of your book, Muhammad Ali, a figure who probably towers over any discussion of sports and activism in the United States. Talk a little bit about Ali, if you would.
I would. I mean, because the book, like I said, is all about that interconnectedness between sports and social movements. And without question, to me, Ali is the high point of that history, because here you have someone who, you know, both symbolically and in practice had one foot in the anti-war struggle of the 60s and one foot in the black freedom struggle, and at the same time is the heavyweight champion of the world. And I got to tell you, like, talking to young audiences about this book, I mean, even people who are very politicized, I mean, like, very politicized, one of the toughest things to sort of get them to see is this idea of you have boxing, which, first of all, a lot of people, you know, see as reactionary, and especially today is almost like a sideshow sport at this point in the United States. But for people to see a boxing match as being something that the aspirations of a movement felt so intimately tied to. So Ali fights in the 60s, and if he wins, there's this feeling of elation, and if he loses, it's like people are scared that, oh my God, if he loses, it's gonna be so difficult for us. And so if I could talk a little bit about that. I've had people also ask me, like, well, why doesn't Ali speak out today, or where are the Alis today? And the first thing to understand is that he was very much a creation of the 1960s. Like, Ali, as we know him, does not exist without the mass movements of the 60s, and I would argue that the movements of the 60s don't exist in the same way without Ali. And to me, the first big step where you see this taking place in the public realm is when he joins the Nation of Islam and changes his name, first from Cassius Clay to Cassius X, and then to Muhammad Ali. And it's from this process that I get the title, and if I could, I'd like to speak a little about where the title, What's My Name, Fool, comes from.
Sure, please do, Dave.
Thanks, Bob. You see, it starts when he changes his name, and once again, for younger audiences, it's hard for people to understand this, but when he changed his name, it sent shockwaves through the sport. It was so incredibly mind-blowing for people. It's like, today, I'm trying to think of similarities for modern comparisons, and I say things like, imagine if, like, Laura Bush joined the Lesbian Avengers.
Or, yeah, it would have to be something like, yeah.
Jenna Bush joins the Iraqi Resistance and marries John Walker Lind.
Yeah, something like that.
Like, titanically huge for people to see how just seismic it was at that time. And because you have the heavyweight champion not only changing his name, but joining the organization of Malcolm X, joining an organization that unapologetically called for self-defense in the South, and just the mobbed-up, corrupt, right-wing fight world just lost their minds. And this name controversy, it really did reach its apex when Ali fought a fighter who was proudly patriotic, a man named Floyd Patterson. Now, Patterson was just very proudly a patriotic guy. He was, like, believed himself to be a staunch integrationist. There's a tragic story about Patterson I won't get into with regards to integration, where he was basically kicked out of his own neighborhood that he was attempting to integrate. So were the times. But Patterson said before the fight, before he fought Ali, he said, I am fighting Clay, and yes, his name is Clay, you know, big slap in the face,
mm-hmm.
as a crusade, you know, once again, language that, you know, Bush is comfortable with today, as a crusade to return the title to America and take it from the black Muslims. And Ali's response was really stunning because there wasn't a response. I mean, here was the most loquacious, you know, fighter ever, the guy they called the Louisville Lip and Gashes Cassius. He doesn't say anything in response. His fury is so deep about this, and he did his talking in the ring, literally. Because as he beats Patterson from pillar to post over 9 rounds, he yells so the press corps can hear, "Come on, America, come on, white America, say my name. Is my name Clay? What's my name, fool?" And that's where the title comes from.
Yeah, and also just to finish up, but to carry the Clay or the Ali story to the next chapter, a couple of years later, at the height of his career, in his mid-20s, when he's arguably the greatest heavyweight ever, or on the verge of establishing himself as such, he refuses induction into the Army.
Right.
And sacrifices over 3 years of his career, literally in the prime time years, and untold tens or hundreds of millions of dollars of income.
Right.
To oppose the war in Vietnam.
"Because I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong,"
yeah.
was his first statement on that when approached about his draft status. And what's so incredible about this is that he embarked on draft resistance in 1964. This is when he really started with that. And if you think about where the anti-war movement was in 64, students of the movement know that it was very small. It was almost entirely white students, dominated by Students for a Democratic Society. So you've got African-American working-class boxing champion standing with that. And David Dellinger, I believe his name is.
Yeah, it is.
Did I get his name right?
You did.
Great. He said that when Ali stood up, he said there are no words for what that did for our movement, because here's someone that the press could not dismiss as cowardly, could not dismiss as bohemian or, you know, some kind of hippie. I mean, and so it gave us all confidence in that way. You're right. He was stripped of his title. And I mean, you could argue that being stripped of his title led to his future physical immiseration.
Yeah, we're talking to Dave Zirin today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Dave Zirin's the author of the brand new book, What's My Name, Fool? We're talking about goes through a lot of history of sports and resistance and politics in the United States, and also a lot of the book and a lot of what I hope to talk about in the second half of the show, dealing with contemporary issues. The phone lines here, if you'd like to call in, are 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We've got a couple callers who've been very patient. Let's go to the phone lines. Urbana, you're on the air with Dave Zirin.
Hi. I'm a little surprised at the tone of this. It's all well and good, I guess, but I've heard the argument that sports channels the natural aggression that people have. And they work out their aggressions in sports, and that therefore it's a good thing. I've always felt just the opposite, that it encourages competition, aggression, warlike mentality. I mean, we still have rivalries between Champaign Urbana and Urbana based on high school sports. I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay, well, thank you very much, caller. Dave, this sort of gets to the issue that we talked about at the outset of the show, but let's talk about it some more. I mean,
no, it's something you have to talk about.
Yeah.
And it's something that I in no way want to run away from, because I think people have every right to raise it. I mean, there's no question that sports can breed like the worst kind of aggression, the worst kind of sort of competitive win at all costs mentality. Just look at the top athletes in our society who, you know, theoretically should be the healthiest people in our society, see their bodies immiserated by everything from steroids to drugs to all kinds of things, just as they, you know, attempt to manage themselves. I mean, the average life expectancy of an NFL football player is roughly a decade less than the average American male. I mean, so there's no question that sports can breed all of this stuff. One of the things I want to do with this book, though, is to try to breed what I call a counter-morality. Because right now the morality in sports is completely skewed, and it's twisted and it's utterly distorted. But there's beauty in sports, too, and there's also resistance in sports. And I think in a more sane society, you really would see sports act as what it should act, which is a way for people to connect with each other, healthy competition, the joy of play, physical exercise. I mean, this is something that every society had. And like you said at the outset, Bob, which is so true, it's like you look at the difference in early Rome between sports when it was a republic versus sports under Caesar. I mean, you could see how deeply sports is a reflection of a society, not that there's some sort of original sin in sports that makes it sort of naturally corrosive.
I mean, I guess getting to the logical extension of the caller's question, would our society be a better place if we didn't have spectator sports? Would energy be channeled in better ways? Would we have better values, happier lives?
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, it's a hard question because it's almost like, would the world be better if the sun was red instead of yellow? I mean, because it is such an ingrained part of our world, I feel like we have to sort of deal with it on its own terms. I mean, it is such an intimate part, and for every person who I've spoken to, you know, going around talking about the book, I mean, it's almost a one-to-one ratio of everybody who talks about how awful sports are. Another person says something like, yeah, well, for me, you know, when I first learned how to, you know, stand up for myself was by playing sports. The first time I ever interacted with a black person or a person of color was in my city's basketball league and broke down racism in ways I never could have imagined. I mean, you get these different stories, and a lot of times, frankly, it's very reflective of who the coaches are, the kind of values they try to teach, and the way sports is integrated in people's lives.
We're talking to Dave Zirin today in Media Matters, author of the brand new book, What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States. We have phone lines open here at Media Matters at 333-9455. Toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Dave Zirin.
Yes, I disagree with the previous caller because I think sports teaches people how to strategize in game situations. And I know my own situation. I think I've gained increased respect for people. Even if, say, I'm a little better basketball player than another person, I still can appreciate what this other person does or a few plays. So, but that's not what I called about. But I was thinking I'm for regulatory capitalism, but I'm thinking, you know, when you see the salaries of these people making well over $1 million a year, and the majority of citizens won't even make $1 million in their lifetime, I think maybe it's time to socialize sports to kind of equate the payroll scene. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, caller. Now, this gets to a section of your book you talk about some length, Dave, and it's really, I think, a very good issue to raise at this point, which is, you know, we have this enormous industry of sports,
right. A
tremendous amount of revenue going into it. I think you call it, if I'm not mistaken, the 10th largest industry or so. Maybe
right. Bigger than U.S. Steel, over $200 billion a year.
And the salaries of the star players are absolutely astronomical. Probably only entertainers and a handful of CEOs come close to equaling the annual salaries of the top athletes in the world. You know, as a progressive, how do you feel about this?
Oh, it's an interesting question. I mean, the first thing is I try to take a holistic view of it. I mean, you do have the, for example, the Alex Rodriguez's making $25 million a year or so, but the overwhelming majority of professional athletes actually make very little, and I go through some of the figures in the books, like what an Arena Football League player makes in a year. An Arena Football League player is only in the last year even won health care. You know, as part of what it means to play in the Arena Football League.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare is not part of a regular boxing contract. Many athletes retire, frankly, penniless, you know, either based because of parasitic management or the fact that the salaries are so low in the first place. A typical minor league baseball player can make about $900 a month. So it's important just to take that big view when we start, but it's also important to take on the question that the caller raises, which is the top end of the salaries. And there are a couple of ways to look at this. I mean, one way to look at it is that the whole reason why there are these big salaries is not just because the pie is so big and the owners are so generous, but because of the history of unions in sports and what they fought for. Like, sports had their biggest expansions in this country in the 1920s and the 1950s, but it took until the late 1960s and the 70s before you actually saw the salaries rise with that. Like, when Dave Megacy played football, he, in the off season, he would work in a quarry, for goodness sakes. I mean, it's hard to imagine a football player today working in a quarry after the season.
Well, it's a year-round job today, for one thing.
Yeah, well, that's very true as well. There's the pressure to train year-round. But even though they couldn't have trained year-round back then if they wanted to, because it meant their families wouldn't have eaten. So in one respect, you got to look at sports as, all right, it's this $200 billion business, and players have organized to get their bigger piece of the pie. And, you know, that's a good thing. You know, I'd rather have the money going to them than going to Steinbrenner, for example. But the flip side of that is you have to say also that there is something quite obscene about the fact that, you know, Alex Rodriguez makes what, like maybe 1,000 times what a teacher makes in this country. And that has everything to do with some of the greed in sports and the big money in sports. You know, the fact that, you know, and this relates very intimately to fans, you know, the fact that, you know, a hot dog can cost, you know, $8 at the game. The fact that you have to pay for absolutely everything. You know, you practically have to pay for the oxygen in some stadiums, publicly subsidized stadiums, which lead to more revenue, which lead to bigger salary caps, which lead to bigger salaries. So there's an aspect where there is a bit of, there is a salary madness in sports. If it wasn't flowing to the players, it would flow to the ownership. It would not flow to the fans.
I mean, Dave, if I can interject, is that where you intervene as a pro-union guy largely? I mean, it's hard to get, you know, worked up about getting huge salaries to Alex Rodriguez or professional athletes at the top end, but if it's just going to go to either Alex Rodriguez or George Steinbrenner, you just as soon have it go to the player?
Well, I mean, I would, but it's also important to realize, like, when you look at some of these union battles that do happen in sports, it's not really Alex Rodriguez taking the lead. I mean, it's very interesting when you look at, like, who the union reps are from each team and how they interact with each other. And talking with Dave Megacy, who's the West Coast head of the NFLPA, has been an eye-opener for me in this regard, because you learn that, like in the previous NFL strikes, you've had things like the quarterbacks club, where all the quarterbacks who usually make the most money and have the most glamour get together to make sure that their interests are protected. Well, meanwhile, your average grunt player, you know, or players who've already retired and need more in terms of their pension or in terms of their medical care, are they getting looked after? That's more like the grunt player, the players on the ground fighting for that. So you also get different interests and different fissures actually inside the players' unions themselves. And I just think people need to look at it more closely in that regard and not look at it just in terms of like, well, it's billionaires versus millionaires. Who really cares? Because when you have things like this latest National Hockey League deal, for example, I don't think that does anybody any favors. I mean, the union just got destroyed in that deal. I mean, eight ways from Sunday, for goodness sakes. And I think any time a collective organized group of people, you know, literally just get immiserated by, you know, some of the richest, most rapacious people in the United States, I don't see how that does anybody any favors.
Dave Zirin, what exactly do owners do in professional sports? What is their contribution to the value that's created by professional sports?
I mean, I think owners bring, I think we'd have a better sports society without owners, whether if teams were owned by communities like the Green Bay Packers, for example, or if they didn't exist at all. I mean, owners, you know, play very different roles depending on the team. A lot of owners today, I mean, because of the values of teams have risen so astronomically, owners today are the richest of the rich. I mean, way back in the day, 100 years ago, you could get someone like Wellington Mara, who is now like 150 years old and still owns the Giants. I mean, it's always been said that he won the Giants in a card game, for example. And that team has always been him and his family's primary source of income. Those days are long gone. Now a typical owner is someone like Mark Cuban, who is a internet billionaire professional annoyance who the team is basically like a toy, a chance for him to be a frat boy well into his 40s.
We're talking to Dave Zirin today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone number, if you'd like to talk to Dave Zirin, author of the brand new book, What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States, is 333-9455 and toll free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Dave Zirin.
Thank you. First, I wanted to make two points, but I want to say I'm not speaking as a fan of any sport. I just don't follow it. But I think that anyone who says that participants in the cultural arts, painting, literature, whatever, participants who are performers or critics or academics are invariably motivated and focused on gentle and humane pursuits is to miss the point. I've been around a university for a long time and have seen these competitive and nasty
right.
characters of human the human side performing. The second point is that I think that point of view that disdains sports fundamentally misunderstands human history and human nature. I have, on several times, very constructively compared the process of painting a picture or performing a play with football, with a football game, where you have a certain number of players. In any era, you have rules, you have certain periods, you have a field, whether it's the canvas of the painting, the field of play, and then we have aesthetics. Obviously, when you listen to people enthuse about sports, they're talking a lot of aesthetics. So I'll leave you with that.
Thank you, caller. Yeah, do you have any comments on that, Dave?
Yeah, that was fantastic. And I think there's an interesting dynamic that's developed with the first three speakers, first three callers, that I want to raise because it's so similar to what happens when I've been going out and speaking about the book, is that, you know, like the first caller, you get someone who stands up and says, what are you talking about? Sports are disgusting, you know. And then the second caller says, what is that person talking about? Sports are great. And what I'm trying to say with the book and what I think was really coming out from the last caller is that it's not that sports are great or not great. It's that, you know, it's that they are what they are, and they can reflect many different aspects of our society, both the good and the bad. And one of the things that frustrates me a little bit is that there is so much bad in sports, like so much patriotism, sexism, racism, homophobia hustled through it. And I feel like it's an incredible battleground for progressives, for people on the left to actually engage with and have it out and challenge those ideas. But too often people are honestly too dismissive of the fan and of the process to even get their hands dirty in some of those political fights.
You know, Dave, I've got to confess that I've probably attended my share of sporting events in my life, probably in the order of several thousand, going back to the 60s, baseball, football, and basketball primarily. And it's been a striking change in tenor in the last 10, 15 years going to a basketball game, which I can hardly do anymore, or a football game, because of the commercialization of the sports experience, where basically if you're in an arena now watching a basketball game, a professional game, or going to a professional football game, at every moment when there's not action on the floor or on the field, you're being bombarded with loud noise selling something. It's really quite extraordinary. And, you know, if you try to organize against this, you're not going to get the players on your side because the revenue comes to them too. And same with the owners. Is there anything that fans can do who are concerned about the sort of commercial marination of sport?
Yes, absolutely. First of all, there's a terrific website that's put on by Ralph Nader and some people who work with him called leagueoffans.org that deals with the question of fans' rights, specifically against commercialization. That has been a great resource for me in examining that. But second of all, what I would say to that is that we've seen in the last couple of years some potential for fans to actually rebel against this just insane commercialization that does exist in sports, which I agree with you, Bob, is mind-numbingly repellent. Because, you know, it's like you don't want to have to be sold something, you know, every second and then have people say, well, this is just what sports is. One of the things that happened a couple of years ago was when Major League Baseball attempted to sell the space on top of second bases around the major leagues for ads for the movie Spider-Man 2. And Major League Baseball totally thought they'd get away with it because they basically thought, you know, basically, frankly, Bob, what you were saying, which is like, well, we've already got the whole arena plastered with ads. Who's going to care with one more thing here? This is great. More money. And fans just rebelled. And it was an awesome kind of rebellion. You know, red state, blue state, all those kinds of, like Washington, D.C. political definitions went out the window as letters, emails, and phone calls just flooded Major League Baseball to the point where they had to withdraw the idea in embarrassment. And it was so interesting to me when that happened because you saw that despite all the vulgarization of sports, it's like people still see an incredible beauty and purity about what occurs on the diamond. Now, whether that's an illusion or not, you know, is another question, considering some of the stuff that goes on the field. But
you know,
the fact,
Dave,
that there was protectiveness to it was really striking.
Yeah, Dave Zirin, we've got a couple of people who have been waiting patiently.
Okay.
But before we get to them, I want to take up another issue or two to make sure we cover, because it's in the book, and I know it's something you've thought about a lot. The other thing you see if you go to sporting events today is what you've already alluded to, the Nationals game in Washington, which is just a supercharged pro-war patriotism that is almost every game I've attended in the last few years. as paying homage to some military performer or another. And you write about Pat Tillman in your book. You have a column or two about Pat. Talk a little bit about him and why he's important.
Well, Pat Tillman's important, and I will try to be brief with this because I know you got folks on the line, but it is an important story because it shows how sports and patriotism can be manipulated, and also how more often than not it's just a disgusting lie. And Pat Tillman's a great example of this. The truth is that he was a football player for the Arizona Cardinals. The truth is that he gave up millions of dollars to join the Army Rangers.
Following 9/11.
After September 11th, joined with his brother. All of that is true. But then here's some other truths that are less known. It's also true that the Bush administration and the Pentagon besieged Tillman to try to get him to do ads for the armed forces. I mean, he was just the perfect poster child. And Tillman refused. So it's like, why did Tillman leave the Cardinals and join the Army Rangers? Frankly, we don't know, because he kept it to himself. He chose not to be kind of like this Stars and Stripes voice of Americana. He chose instead just to go into the forces and do his thing. And even if one, like I would disagree with him doing it, his reasons were his own, and he refused to be a shill for the government. Now, he died in battle, of course, and then the Pentagon had something that they was much more useful to them than a live, non-helpful Tillman, which was a dead, pliant Tillman. And they used Pat Tillman after his death. They did a nationally televised funeral. Bush addressed the fans of the Arizona Cardinals over the Jumbotron at their stadium. You know, now they had somebody. The problem was that this was all a lie as well. As it's now well known, Tillman died at the hands of friendly fire, at the hands of his own troops. And what's so vile about the entire situation was that his parents were not told about this until weeks after the fact, even though the Pentagon knew. His own brother, who was in his Army Ranger battalion, was not told. So what they did was they made his whole family basically be props in a PR stunt at this nationally televised funeral. I mean, it boggles the mind, like, how cynical the people are who run. I mean, you may know it in the abstract, but then you hear about something like this, and it just boggles the mind. And therefore, what's happened in the aftermath is that Tillman's parents, Pat Sr. and Mary, have spoken out quite trenchantly against the Bush administration and against the war. And it's like, I think that for people who are against the war, we should be giving the Tillmans our every support in their desire to find out the truth about their son's death and to call out the hypocrisy of the Bush administration.
We're talking to Dave Zirin today on Media Matters. We've only got about 10 minutes left. We've got a couple callers who've been waiting very patiently. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Dave Zirin.
Hi. Well, one thing I wanted to say is that rising to the defense of Chomsky, not that he needs much, but maybe he was critical of sports fans in the past, but the way he usually frames it is that he's very impressed by the way they follow things so closely. And one line that I think he has used in the past was that if people followed politics the way they followed sports, things would be different. I mean, people would know Halliburton's contracts and that sort of thing, as opposed to he's not dissing the fans. I think he's dissing the system. So putting that aside, I wanted you to say something about roids. I don't listen to sports talk radio very much, but I did today a little and yesterday because I wanted to see what the reaction to a fellow that's been sort of lionized by Bush, and Bush says he still believes him, I suppose, is something that you said in your column on Counterpunch. So I wanted you to at least get a word in edgewise on all these juiced players, and it seems to me that that's just more debilitation of the sport. I frankly detest football and boxing, and I gather it's a flaw in me to some extent, because all workers, you know, have injuries that go along with the work, it seems, but I think it shouldn't be glorified and shouldn't be intrinsic to the game as opposed to something that's incidental. But then I guess I do watch soccer and basketball, and they're pretty dangerous too. So anyway, if you could spin on that a while, and since there's so little time, I'll let go here.
Well, thank you very much. And Dave, maybe a little background for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with the steroids crisis in baseball.
Sure. I mean, I think first of all, the steroids quote unquote crisis is, I would argue, largely a manufactured crisis. It's a way for the commissioner of Major League Baseball, Bud Selig, to actually get the union, basically, and submit the union to some kind of rule. Now, the union, the Major League Baseball union, which I would argue is the strongest, most united union in the United States, not just sports unions, has been split on this, like they've never been split on anything, because as you could understand that there are players in their ranks who want testing, who are tired of, like, the guy at the locker next to him get inflated statistics by what they think is because of illegal means or cheating. So it's caused this quote-unquote crisis. This crisis exacerbated when Jose Canseco, a person with no credibility whatsoever for a lot of reasons, put out this book, Juiced, which became a bestseller, where he named names as far as turned rat, as they used to say, as far as players who, quote-unquote, used the juice in the past. Now, there's so much hypocrisy on the steroid question, it's like it's hard to know where to begin in terms of talking about it. You know, they're talking about putting asterisks on players' records who may have taken steroids. They never talk about putting asterisks on players who played before 1947 when there was only white players, or, you know, or before 1968 when they lowered the pitching mound. So, I mean, baseball's records have always been fluid and whatnot in that regard. The other thing about steroids is, like, all these, the guy talked about listening to sports radio, the last caller, a lot of these sports chatterboxes on the air, they've all of a sudden turned into medical doctors when talking about this. And it's funny to listen to because they contradict themselves so quickly. Like, they say things like, look at Rafael Palmeiro hitting into his 40s. Look at Barry Bonds hitting into his 40s. They must be on the juice. Then in the next sentence they say, look at Nomar Garcia Parra, like, getting his groin disconnected from his body. Look at Mark McGwire having to retire in his early 30s. Your body breaks down when you take the juice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, which is it? You know, so it's like they don't know what they're talking about, and it would be great to have someone, and I'm not going to pretend like I know what I'm talking about, but it would be great to have someone who actually knows about the effects. I mean, if steroids are good for you, well, gee, shouldn't we all be taking them?
Yeah.
And if they, you know, it's like, huh? What are we really talking about here? And it's like, wow, Rafael Palmeiro looks great, and he's still hitting.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting there's considerable medical evidence on the other side that the concern about steroids is exaggerated if they're taken well. And a lot of bodybuilders have lived a long lives taking steroids actively, apparently.
So people get sick if they're abused? Well, people get sick if you abuse Advil, for goodness sakes. I mean, it's just a difficult thing to get your head around. There's just kind of this obsession to sort of get the cheaters. And it has this kind of bizarre witch hunt atmosphere. And the only thing that I've taken pleasure in, frankly, in this whole thing is the fact that Rafael Palmeiro got pinched, as I wrote in my column this past week, which I took pleasure in because he was so sanctimonious about it. He is a big crony of Bush, and it's now looking like Bush basically ran a steroid crack house for the Texas Rangers in the early 1990s, only now to come out like Elmer Gantry against steroids.
We're talking to Dave Zirin today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Dave Zirin is the author of the brand new book, What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States, just published by Haymarket Books. We have time for one more caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 4, Edgar County, you're on the air with Dave Zirin.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You were talking earlier about Muhammad Ali, and I'm sitting at my desk here and looking at a picture of me with Howard Cosell. And I knew Howard in the 60s and the 70s and worked with him. And I think that he was the one person who so much helped
yes.
Muhammad Ali survive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I know in talking with him, one of the reasons that he did it is because he was Jewish. And he saw the discrimination that he faced, and he wasn't going to let it happen to anybody else. And when it came to the sports situation, he was very active in working with the Olympics and promoting the Olympic athletes, but he wanted to keep the sport pure. And, of course, salaries were different, you know, 35 years ago than they are now. But I just wondered if you wanted to comment on that.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Yeah, Dave, maybe we haven't spoken much about this, but you know, your opening chapter is on Lester Rodney, the sports writer, and the role he played. In your sports journalist, I mean, how does the sports journalist community respond to you and your work? I mean, do you feel like you're isolated? Do you find other journalists who are sympathetic to your concerns, who are willing to take chances like Cosell did in the 1960s to advocate on the behalf of Muhammad Ali when Muhammad Ali was hardly a popular figure in the news media otherwise?
Well, I would argue that overwhelmingly sports journalism in the United States is, either unrepentantly toes a company line or is unrepentantly right-wing. I think there are some very notable exceptions to that, like Sally Jenkins, who writes for The Washington Post, Jason Whitlock, Mike Lupica at his best, just talking about some of the top-tier writers.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Blackstone in Dallas. I'll tell you, I'm starting to see, it's interesting, it's like I wrote this book and it was almost like throwing a shot in the dark to see what else was out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to see it's like there are other people out there who are like, hey, this is a good thing, I'm glad you're doing this. Like, there's a piece on the book today in the New York Daily News, and I don't know how much you know about the Daily News out there, but, you know, it ain't exactly the Daily Worker.
Yeah.
You know? And the piece happened because the writer of the piece, I don't think he would mind me saying this, he's a great writer, Michael O'Keefe, he gave me a call, and he was just like, hey, man, you're really saying this for a lot of us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's great that you're saying this. A lot of us want to be saying some of this stuff, so let me try to give your book some pub in the Daily News, you know? Let's get it out there a little bit.
Well, I think between the Daily News and this show, you're probably going to see your sales figures skyrocket in the next 24 hours.
That would be great.
Yeah, okay. Dave, we've only got about a minute or two left, and there's so much I wanted to talk about in terms of sexuality and gay issues in sports.
I actually did a gay sports talk show.
Yeah, well, no, it's so important, and there's also the issue of race in sport. But let's, if we can, because we're in Illinois, let's close, if we can, talking about the issue of Indian nicknames for sports teams, because that's an issue that's central to the University of Illinois with their chief mascot. What's your take on all this?
Oh, I mean, I think it's minstrelsy. I think that people who organize against this, against the use of Native American imagery in sporting events, I think are doing the top work and some of the most important work as far as social justice work in the area of sports right now. I think people in Florida have a fight on their hands because the Florida State Seminoles are standing firm against a recent NCAA ruling that says that they don't want any Native American names in any of their sanctioned playoffs. And so people there are going to have to organize against it. I mean, I think it's minstrelsy, pure and simple. It's about basically laughing at a once proud people who are victims of genocide in this country. And we could go through a whole thing about my hometown, the Washington Redskins, and the origins of that name.
Now, that's a professional team where you don't have irate alumni refusing to give money and
right.
Threatening to get the chancellor fired if the chancellor goes against them. I mean, what gives with the Washington Redskins or the Cleveland Indians?
Let's talk the Redskins here, because I think by talking about the Redskins, I think it should make people in Champaign resolute about what they're doing against the chief out there, because it shows you some of the roots of this stuff. The Washington Redskins were named by their founder and first owner, a man named George Preston Marshall. Marshall was an arch segregationist. He moved the team from Boston to Washington as an effort to have Washington be the South's team. At that time, Washington Redskins were the most southernmost NFL team in the United States. And he chose the name Redskins quite deliberately as a way to sort of play to, white southern workers, as to play to their racism. If Preston Marshall could have called his team the Washington Amos and Andes, he would have. And he didn't just because he couldn't have gotten away with that, but calling them the Redskins allowed them to appeal to that kind of racism. And I think that's what naming teams after Native Americans is all about. Now, what's interesting is that today, the Washington Redskins have been under fire by all kinds of legislation, court cases, all kinds of stuff, saying that the name's got to go.
Dave Zirin, unfortunately, on that note, I've got to cut you off because the band's tuning up in the background,
okay,
which means they're going to throw us out of the studio.
Maybe another time.
Maybe another time. There's so much more to talk about and a lot more in the book. Dave Zirin, thank you for joining us. Dave Zirin is the author of What's My Name, Fool, Sports and Resistance in the United States, published by Haymarket Books. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on Media Matters. Please come back in 167 hours for yet another episode. Thanks to Andrew Boyle for doing a great job as producer. See you next week.